Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Writing / Politics, and more about what that means later, and it's about turning political concerns into poetry, right? And our guest for this episode is Robin Clark, who knows something about this, right? Introduce yourself, Robin. What's your deal?
Well, it's great to be here. I think about it a lot. I don't know if I know anything, but I struggle with making poetry that, you know, wants great poetry, wants to be free, and politics often wants to be dogmatic, and I believe this, and I have this agenda. So that's a dialectic that I plays out in my writing, and I teach about it, try to, and increasingly, you know, am more and more of an activist in different contexts, organizing faculty in the city and organizing around housing, and so these political concerns are in my heart and kind of teeming in the room all the time, and find their way into my poetry. And how to do that and not just rant, you know, is a real challenge. And usually it doesn't work the first time. But that's, you know, it's what I concern myself with.
Working. Things not working the first time.
Yes.
It's all about failure, isn't it?
It is. That's what Ben Lerner would say. He was my teacher and he talks a lot about failure. But I do think, to do political art involves a constant recognition of my limits and failures and writing some really shitty drafts. And I mean, I guess this is true of all poetry, but it seems even more so. I mean, it's so depressing, this world we live in. And how do you write about that with any kind of creative energy? You know, depression, despite what people say, I don't think is good for art. Mm-hmm. Passion is good for art. Joy is good for art. Joy, even amongst sorrow, is necessary. And so it is multiple drafts that eventually either get better or just go in the trash can. But it's not... every once in a while, a little gem will be gifted to me by the gods, but often it's really a struggle.
So wait, so if depression's bad for art, I mean, have you heard the Smiths?
No.
And Morrissey?
There's no way they were depressed. I mean, they were performing angst and, well, no, the Cure was performing angst.
Yes.
The Smiths are performing, oh, petulant dissatisfaction. And despair. See, despair is not the same as depression.
Mm.
Depression is leveling. Despair is a great height to which one rises. Just ask Rilke.
Yes, yes. Or depth, or whatever.
Depth, height, yep.
Yes. You know, so you're writing in this era, you know, so is your poetry, I guess, you know, sort of like, what do you, you know, as the poetry, do you see it as a site of resistance? Like, what are you pushing against?
Yeah, I'm resisting, it is a site of resistance, and it can be personal. I mean, just for me to, like, live to see another day and to want to continue resisting the poems, writing the poems gives me some energy to do that. And I think... certainly resisting, you know, capitalism, basically unregulated capitalism, forms of exploitation, forms of injustice. A lot of what I think about, there's a kind of essential core of a kind of suffering that's, you know, the suffering of the child who's lived through trauma in a dysfunctional household, and the suffering of a factory worker, of miner, these forms of extreme disempowerment and despair. I think they're this. I think they come from the same place, and I think when that place starts mattering to us more than money, as a society, really starts mattering, that's when change will happen. And so I kind of, and it's good for me to make that matter for me and to put that into the world. Does it do anything? I don't know. It does something for me, and I'm one little activist. So yes, even if all it ever does is give me the energy to be pissed off and hopeful and want to change things, then it's done enough in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, we have this sort of rhetoric or this idea, well, you know, is business is the only thing that accomplishes things.
Yeah.
Right? You know, job creation. It's about the jobs, you know, awful minimum wage, below poverty wage jobs, but they're good jobs, you know, at least they exist, at least you have one or something, you know, kind of thing. So if we could talk, actually, one of the things you've kind of fallen, or not, I don't say kind of become involved with lately is sort of, speaking of unregulated capitalism, this, you know, gentrification that has happened in the city of Pittsburgh, that it's kind of changing in weird and creepy ways.
Yes. And I didn't, you know, I didn't expect to get involved with that fight, but I, you know, I moved to East Liberty a couple of years ago, and I'm part of a co-housing cooperative garden group, and we're gentrifiers. We don't want to be, you know, we don't have super expensive houses. I mean, there's crazy, quote unquote, green renovations that are insanely expensive. There's a house that's going to be $800,000. On a street where a 19-year-old was murdered by the police. But we are, and I can't live with that.
Yeah.
And I can't live with watching my neighbors, you know, who have become part of our lives and who, just from casually witnessing, are like so important to the street that they live on, and they're watching them get evicted, watching private sellers, you know, do what's in their right to do, which is sell it whenever they want, and who cares what happens to the resident. And it's so devastating. And so trying to bring some bad press to this, like, rage for, you know, real estate and this sort of, you know, you were saying there's this sort of business is all that matters, and I think the same is true around development, you know, new shops and this language around fighting crime are all that people seem to care about, and East Liberty is so much better. Well, you know, community is when people can live generation after generation in their neighborhood, and they can have support networks, and it's very similar to the situation with faculty, you know, this life of contingency. There's such a life of contingency. And I think, you know, speaking truth to power and really bringing bad press and pushing developers and politicians to demand, sort of, it's a human right. Housing is a human right.
Yeah. Which, you know, is sort of the weird thing, and maybe how poetry speaks to that is because it deals with these abstractions.
Yeah.
You know, because all of these things that you were talking about, or we're talking about, it does make financial sense, quote unquote, or at least the way our economy works, you know, and the way financing works. It makes financial sense to, you know, buy low, sell high, and do whatever you have to do. But, you know, and this hasn't been a great era for the humanities at all. Or the human, yeah. You know, we can make economic arguments, but we can't make moral ones anymore, I don't think. You know, and so how poetry kind of fits into that gap.
Yeah, I think it does. It's a space to think differently than the culture is telling you you're supposed to think, and to care to embody to share, to talk about a set of values that are not necessarily being talked about. I don't know what the hell children are learning to value. You know, there's that book, Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Fairness, yeah. You know, share with others. And I think it's not naive to hold on to those values as an adult. And we need spaces where we can commit to that. And I do think, I don't think poetry inherently has to be that. Poetry can be, you know, about images, and it can be just as valuable doing that. You know, I don't really judge one form of poetry over another. I know what I want to write and what I want to read, but I think we do long for spaces in which to have that conversation.
Yeah, and I guess too, I mean, you know, poetry being sort of inherently not commercial.
Sure.
Or economically valuable, it allows it to become a place where at least other ideas, I think, about the human experience can be explored, and where other people can sort of reach in and, you know, think through other people's experiences.
Yeah.
I think it's really important, as opposed to sort of, you know, the mainstream discourse of, you know, a few years ago I was watching the news and they said, you know, that the job numbers or the GDP or some abstract number was getting better, and the anchors actually did like fist pumps because the economy was suddenly better and we fixed everything, and it was that close to like the Steelers winning the Super Bowl or something, as far as people not grasping, you know, or putting all of their faith in this abstract idea of economy and not other ways of interpreting the world or thinking about life or
whatever. I don't even think that ended up being true. I mean, I think that was the kicker, was that there weren't all these jobs suddenly, and the way they were calculating that were not accurate. And
yeah, because if you're out of work long enough, it just doesn't count anymore.
You just
disappear.
Yeah.
So you go off and the numbers get better. So
that's the model of, you know, fighting crime and East Liberty, actually. It's just, if you can just, people are getting disappeared. That's exactly, you know, buildings are sold, and then in order for residents to get into new housing, they suddenly have to have a credit check.
Oh, wow.
Like, really? Of course, you know, if I had great credit, I probably wouldn't have been in Section 8 housing in the first place. I wouldn't have been living in your crappy building in the first place. And, you know, things like having a record, but like not like a felony, but like a citation.
Oh, wow.
Or can bar you from housing.
Like a speeding ticket?
I don't know. You know, I don't know the ins and outs of citations, but that's like the first thing I think of is the citation that I got as a speeding ticket. So it's a filtering process that, you know, there's a reason that, you know, since 1980, we have 20,000 fewer black people living in Pittsburgh.
Wow, I didn't know
that. And more in the suburbs. And we have more white people in Pittsburgh and fewer in the suburbs. And that's exactly what's happening, is that people are getting displaced to Penn Hills, McKeesport, areas where there's no public transit, away from their kids' schools, away from their churches, away from the person who babysits for them, away from a walkable grocery store. And it's ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
Or it's an ethnic class cleansing, some hybrid of the two. And we can't let that continue. Yeah. We have to do something.
Yeah. Which, and you think too, I mean, this town is also, I mean, it is so segregated.
It's so
very segregated. You know, I've been told, and I've actually seen this, if you look at a census map from like the 1880s and the 2010 census in terms of population distribution, it still looks the same. But population distribution by race, it still looks virtually the same. Like, that hasn't necessarily changed, or, well, it hasn't, I guess, in like places like, I guess, Hazelwood, where a lot of the people left Hazelwood, the euphemism was, well, we no longer know our neighbors, which, come on. You know what I mean? That's the euphemism for these people who didn't look like us moved in.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, you know, and suddenly, oh, we felt unsafe or whatever, you know, and not thinking about even, you know, larger abstract things like the Monfait Expressway or, you know, the Civic Arena project.
Right.
That really was itself a forcible, I mean, those people were eminent domained out of the connection between the Hill District and downtown. And to think the Hill didn't get a grocery store until, what, 3 years ago?
Could be right.
It was torn down in the 50s, and I think that Shop and Save opened up this decade, I want to say.
Jeez.
Yeah, so here is, it's happening again.
Yes. Yep. Yes. And it'll happen to you. It'll happen to Homewood next, and unless we organize, and people are organizing. You know, that this recent 400 unit eviction wave at Penn Plaza, those tenants are organizing. Those tenants are much like the tenants at the Penn Towers organized in the 2000s when their homes were being torn down. They got through tenants' councils. They fought, they filed a lawsuit, they got major demands met that they never would have gotten if they hadn't done that. And it's really exciting to see that. On the North Side Fair Housing Coalition, the residents actually own, they're part owners in their own property, and they partly manage it. It's resident owned. They bought the building. And they are very organized, and that model is amazing, and it's something that I'd love to see spread. I think it's possible.
Yeah. So what then in terms of the role of, you know, creativity and art and humanity, yeah, in this political action? You know, yeah, how are those two things sort of reconciled? Maybe for you or in your life or in your creativity.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is just that. So, in the Communist Manifesto, there's this great line that, like, that's very famous of, like, something like capitalism manufactures its own grave diggers, or the bourgeoisie creates its own grave diggers, and that's absolutely true. I mean, you see that at universities where they've so exploited part-time faculty that the part-time faculty have no choice but to resist and to try to tear down some of these exploitative structures. And I think when conditions become so egregious, your life, it's the politics take over your own life. There's no longer a distinction. And when there's not a distinction between everyday life or intimate life and politics and economics, how could there be a distinction between art? If your art is coming from who you are, then it's going to permeate, in as much as you let it permeate yourself, your being, your consciousness, it's going to permeate your art. And it's just, honestly, like, when you can't be sheltered from the storm, then you write about the storm. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, when the proletariat, for Marx, is so exploited that it has no choice but to resist, then it just happens. So I think it's maybe a barometer. I don't know. Maybe the politicization of poetry is a barometer of how severe class inequality has, you know, is in a particular moment. It would be interesting to think it through that way. What kind of life do you have to be able to write a really domestic kind of poem that, you know, takes place within, you know, a pretty nice house with everything you need.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this great line from Gayatri Spivak who said, she was writing about a Margaret Drabble novel that I haven't read. And it's just a kind of, you know, domestic story of the nuclear family household, the bourgeois household. And Spivak says it's not that this is in and of itself is wrong, but why is this deemed the most important story worth telling? And I think if we're living right, then there's stories that need to be told. And they can be told any number of ways, but they should be in our consciousness in some way.
Yeah, which I always, yeah, you know, I remember remarking, I had to read for comps exams or something, Pride and Prejudice. And so you have this house that's like maintained by servants. And in my edition, I think it was page 203, somebody finally got a name. You know what I mean? Like, food would just appear and things would just happen and be set up. And that was a named person, finally.
Yeah.
You know, and you think about that's a very, you know, am I ripping on Jane Austen? I don't know. I guess I am. Limited understanding of the human experience.
Yeah.
And I guess you think about also, too, I mean, if we want to talk about hard theory, you know, think about Adorno and this sort of idea of the sort of culture industry sort of reinforcing, you know. You're talking about this gentrification. I was thinking about, you know, I had one of my few moments of watching mainstream network TV this weekend or whatever, and there's those, like, extreme home makeover shows where, like, you know, like, we'll just fix your house and it'll be magic and wonderful and it'll solve all of your problems, which is what a weird way of thinking about home. If you think about it.
Yes. And the obsession around home and the obsession, I mean, just being in East Liberty, the amount of construction that's happening, and this, you know, continually buying more and getting new floors, redoing the kitchen. And it's shocking. And it's such an insular, it does feel almost like, a kind of escapism in and of itself. Like being a shopaholic or something, but it's like you're improving something. You're improving the wallpaper. Something's happening. Yeah. Something meaningful's happening.
Yeah, that was even, you know, Pimp My Ride, if you want to go that far back, you know, it was these people who, you know, were obviously driving these cars because they live in some sort of, you know, suburban or even if it's Los Angeles, urban car culture hell, you know. Yeah. And then it would suddenly be, oh, well, you know, but I'm going to get this car fixed. I'm going to get it. It's going to come back to me, and this is going to change my life. And it's like, no, you're just going to have a lot more to pay in insurance and really worry about where you park it all the time.
Now, that's funny, though, because that just reminded me how much, like, as a poet, I've, like, obsessed over getting a book published. Like, that's going to change my life. If I can just win this contest. It's like playing a lottery. Because nobody wants to, you know, this stupid experimental poetry anyways. It's like the dream, this seeking this dream, this American dream, you know? And now we're getting, we could go a little spiritual with this.
I'm comfortable with that. If we can go that way. Yeah, I'm comfortable with that.
You got to light some incense first or I can't move forward.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm fresh out.
See, nobody would have smelled, no one would have known on the podcast.
Sorry. Well, I gotta be real. I gotta be honest.
Yeah, you know, keeping it real.
Artifice and razor blade edits and all of that.
There is absolutely no incense burning right now. I want everyone to know.
There's no incense. There's a lot of nice books in this room, though. You gotta admit.
I would admit that.
Yeah, but anyway, on to the spiritual.
Yeah, I mean you know, the wonderful Pittsburgh activist Mel Packer. Who everyone surely will know as soon as I say his name. You know, I think he identifies as an anarchist, and he says it's a revolution and an evolution. And I think that's sort of true. I think that, and this is why I bother with writing in terms of political action, why I think it has value, is it puts a new energy in the world. It renews myself. You know, it's so daunting and often depressing to work against power and also painstaking, like organizing is painstaking, and how do you like fill the recharge the wellspring of energy, and writing really does that for me too. And I think it's not just about changing institutions, it's not just about claiming power, but it really is. And I think that's what you were kind of touching on when you're saying we don't really make moral arguments, we don't know how, we don't really envision that another world is possible, and dream. And I think that stuff really matters. I think, and which is why I like organizing, because I think it's a really helpful practice.
Yeah.
But poetry brings me back to that place too. It's like, I can imagine otherwise. I can wish for and write about the world that I want to see. And I can speak back to the world that I do see in ways that aren't actually afforded by that world. There isn't necessarily a place where my voice actually matters. Voting does not affect most outcomes. Even if my person wins, it doesn't result in the change that I had believed in.
But I'm pumped.
So, I remember when, in 2008, when Obama won, my friends Sten and Emily, who are both wonderful poets, made a CD called Barack Obama is My President. And there was a song that was like, that was the refrain, Barack Obama, Barack Obama, Barack Obama is my president. And we were dancing around and we were so happy. And I couldn't believe that this thing had happened. And then the corporate collusion, bringing more drones and more war than Bush had, all of that happened, and it was depressing. So I think it was like a hard lesson that my voice did not matter. Being a Democrat did not matter.
Yeah.
And so poetry is a place where I'm creating a space for a voice, and others are creating a space for a voice, and I have a place to listen, and I value that.
my thought about that was, is that it was almost sort of like, I don't know, like, you're right. I mean, it was this misplaced hope in sort of the big picture, and not, I don't know, solving things for ourselves or, I don't know. But so is poetry is this place that sort of rejuvenates. If you could indulge me and us, what does that sound like? What does that sound like?
What does a poem sound like?
Yes, what does a poem sound like?
Well, yeah. I will read a is rejuvenating happy? Does it have a happy ending? Does it have to have a happy ending to be a rejuvenating poem? I don't think so.
No.
And this poem will put that to the test. So this is from a book I'm working on called Children and Corporations.
Oh.
And such an unlikely pair.
Yes.
And the book begins with a quote from Terry Gilliam from a totally fucked up movie called Tideland.
Oh, that's such a great
maybe
film.
The most fucked up movie of all time. And what was most fucked up is that I felt, I didn't have Jaliza Rose's childhood, but mine was pretty fucked up. And I felt such a level of identification with this. It's a very surreal movie, and the way children and imagination, the way children respond with resiliency and imagination towards conditions of horror. Her dad's a heroin addict and
dead.
And dead.
Quickly. For a good part of that film.
Yeah. On screen. So he's, and the best thing about this film is that he begins with this giant close up of Terry Gilliam's head and like a black background, the first moment of the film. And he says, the thing about children is, when you drop them, they tend to bounce. And the whole film is her kind of bouncing through. So that's the epigraph to the book. Children and or corporations. Children are corporations too. There's no end to them. Like light in Norway, near the solstice. There's no ruling Nietzsche, children, and or corporations. Bacchanalian infants understand nothing about suffering. Bacchanalian corporations at their apex do not apologize. Infants do not ask permission or think to stop whatever it is they are doing. Except some children, like you, like me, have been damaged. Some children know about consequences. Some children are haunted by consequences, like a cry turned inward. Only an infant would blow up the last mountain to get what's inside. But the injured ones know they live there. So, I mean, you know, not uplifting in the traditional sense, but, like, I don't know.
Well, I think there's at least, I think, a moment of realization there, which yeah. I think is really important, and a moment of, you know, that embodiment of, you know, an ability to, I think, just think through someone else's experience, but also then thinking through one's own experience.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I always find when working with students, there's this innate, you know, it almost goes back to, you know, Betty Friedan and the feminine mystique, you know, that her idea, the concept of the problem with no name. And everybody sort of knew that it was there, and she was just able to kind of put it together and articulate it, you know. I think in a lot of respects, working with young people who just sort of been born into this world of, I mean, how scary is this? I mean, in another year or two, my freshmen, our freshmen, they won't remember a pre-9/11. They barely remember, this year's freshmen barely remembered pre-9/11 world. Certainly didn't have any sort of political understanding of what it meant to not constantly be at war or whatever. They're just sort of born into this, and there are so few voices, especially if you have that sort of like mainstream suburban childhood. I mean, other people, and I think that's what your poem's talking about, those people's other kinds of childhoods that people have that kind of, I know, and I know mine was sort of the same way. I mean, both of my parents were such eccentric people. I think it forced me kind of outside of the can I say happy normal world? Yeah, happy normal world that everybody else had kind of lived through, you know. But for these students that have kind of had that, or just, you know, they go see Ant-Man or whatever, that's an actual movie, you know, Ant-Man. I saw the trailer for that, and I was like, that's a joke, right? Like, at least one of these trailers has to be, no. But if you have Ant-Man, there might be some kind of, like, subversion in there, I don't know. But I think it's so hard, even, it's not real subversion. To even articulate, I think, on their half, what the questions are. They know something's wrong, but they don't even know the questions to ask to figure out exactly what that is. It's like the language is missing.
And I think, that's why I love teaching, because even teaching poetry, you know, I can teach I can teach the most radical forms of critique through poetry in a way that I can't, and I don't have to present that as my ideology. I just, you know, we just read the poem, we talk about the poem, and it's there, and they suddenly have to grapple with it. And I've seen some really amazing conversations happen, because, I mean, for me, the best political poetry isn't didactic. This is maybe more, I don't know if that's a didactic poem I read, but I think art should not mean but be. And even when it's political, even when it has an agenda, it has to continue to be mysterious. And I think as a poet, that's like the great challenge. I taught this class last semester that was about how do you write about politics and how do you do it. You know, we become so rigid in our political ideas, and that's like that's death for poetry, that rigidity. Mm. You know, the late Tomas Shalaman, brilliant Slovenian poet, I was fortunate for him to be my teacher, and he he would say total freedom. And how do you have total freedom and critique capitalism? Like, I'm not free to do anything. Mm-hmm. I have some things I kind of want to say. And I think the same is true for writing about, for example, any kind of trauma, any kind of narrative that you're really attached to. Like, this is what happened. I need to tell it this way because that's the truth. And I think the poem that I read partly interests me because it made me really uncomfortable to write the first part because, like, I don't identify with the infant who has infinite desires and can infinitely receive them, have them fulfilled. But that's the ideal infant. I mean, the ideal infant should be just like a corporation, unregulated. Like, that's just, they are not socialized. They are entitled to just drink milk and shit while they drink it. And, you know, cry while they shit and drink milk. And, but that, and it made me uncomfortable. You know, that poem is also kind of in response to, or an homage to the poet Anne Boyer, who has this beautiful poem called How a Revolution. And it's just a litany. How a revolution is like this, how a revolution is like that. But it's comparing a revolution to a child and to a newborn and all the ways that a revolution is unruly, is you can't control it. You don't know how it's going to turn out. But you love it anyway. And I think for somebody with a strong ideology, like, right, like Marx knew exactly how the revolution would turn out. Mm-hmm. He had scientific conclusions about it, and a certain rigid kind of Marxism is really attached to that narrative. And I think it's politically dangerous and tempting. And it's also, like, really dangerous. It's dangerous for humans to be kind of in that rigid space. Mm-hmm. It's why we can't really talk to each other, you know? We're Democrats, maybe, and we're just, like, already waiting for the Republican to shut up so we can say what we want to say. There's no space for change.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like... the other thing I like about poetry and doing this in poetry is that it forces me out of my worst rigidity, my worst totalitarian, you know, theories about the world, and forces me to, like, really, if you're going to write a good poem, you have to be awake to every possible, you know, Adrienne Rich says that the freedom night can turn into day, love can turn into hate, you know, the freedom to call any word by another name.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's a good challenge to have when you're trying to make the world a better place. It's like, it's a challenge to really look at everything and listen to everything, listen to others.
I have this sort of genesis of an idea that I'm kind of working on, and actually I'm just going to talk through it because I don't know if it necessarily it's fully perfected in my mind or figured out yet, but I something I want to call, like, the tyranny of perfection. Because, and I think it's that, you know, we live in a world of engineering and test marketing and using even, like, sort of psychology to market things or to construct things, you know, sort of like the limits of human perception have been figured out. You know, so there's this great, you say about children and corporations, there's this great book, not great book, it's a horrible book called Brand Child. And it's basically how, it's this textbook to market, kind of, how this is how you market all products to children, even product, and it makes the argument, even products that children can't buy, you should, like mutual funds. There's an argument as to why children have at a very young age, good feelings about mutual funds. And I've read some critiques of it, and this is one of the things is, you know, we've taken Jean Piaget, who sort of understands child, who created this comprehensive theory of child development. We've taken Piaget out of education, which is where he started, and it's in marketing that has embraced, you know, early childhood development as a model for how to do business. Not, we've taken it out of education, which is what it was designed for. But I think about how, you know, and again, if you have, you know, sort of blockbuster culture or mainstream culture or whatever, I think it's very easy to get this idea, or even like with food culture and like chain restaurants and the same taste everywhere. I think it's very easy to get this false perception about life that everything just comes out perfect, or everything is sort of decided or recognizable or good, and there's no possibility for growth or recreation or reimagination. But that's the world we live in, though, or we live in a lot of the time. You know, I remember even just a couple of decades ago when, like, even new cars didn't work sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or you know, you'd have limits on your ability to talk to people because of the phone, you know, or you have to wait till after 7 because it costs less to call long distance or whatever. And now you can kind of have anything right away immediately.
Yes.
And I wonder what... I've started to wonder about what that's done to people. If you, as just human who's imperfect or whatever, engages with that world and then tries to speak back to that world or tries to create in that world, and if it doesn't, it doesn't come out as good as Star Wars, you're just screwed. You know what I mean? You have no hope.
I mean,
and I just wonder what that does for people's ability to, I don't know, be human or question or grow or do anything.
Right. I mean, it's a world that's feels prefabricated in a certain way, and it's kind of alien. You're actually kind of alienated from it because it's just like kind of presented to you. And everything is so, I mean, this is not a new idea, but everything is so narcissistically presented. Everything is, you know, iPhone. Everything is about my unique experience with
the world,
Marshall's or, department store, or
I like the Amazon, which is sort of ideological. Treat yourself today.
Yeah.
You know, which is I do need that.
Yeah.
This would make me feel I deserve this kind of thing.
And like what constitutes really taking care of yourself, and what would be like Foucault on self-care, what would be a really radical form of self-care, right? He said the Greeks would engage in this process where they would actually evaluate. They would ask themselves questions like, how do I feel about my day? How do I feel about what I'm supposed to do with my day? And instead of that, it's this sort of superficial, and I'm not saying superficial as a judgment. Like, I mean, literally, like it's not penetrating consciousness in a sustained way. And we're being kept above the surface constantly, constantly redirected, like a website that's constantly redirecting you.
And I think about, you know, this sort of, we live in this era of just chronic unhappiness too, you know, or the thing that I've seen lately, thanks Facebook, is folks that I knew once from other eras in my life becoming really embittered and really resentful as they've gotten older.
Yeah.
You know, because they didn't win, or they think other people are winning, or whatever, or they're people who are refusing to play and they're the real winners or whatever, you know. Kind of, so then you get this sort of random, you know, welfare queen's Facebook post or something, and it's like, whoa, what happened to you? Whoa, you know. Kind of thing, and I just, again, I think about those folks, and I'm thinking, maybe it's actually your choices. Maybe it's that you did everything that you were supposed to do, and it didn't work out. And it's not fulfilling, though it should be. And it's just sort of shoving the square peg into the round hole, you know, and the kind of rage and bitterness, and, you know, as we're saying this, Donald Trump is now the leading candidate for the Republican nomination.
My God.
And it's the guy who said that, you know, basically Mexicans are subhuman. And that gets people to go, yes, I'm into that.
Yeah.
You know, that calling someone else subhuman, another group of people, can still win perhaps, or at least get you to the head of the pack.
It's really insane. I mean, it feels insane.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's never a moment, that's not true, but for a lot of people, I don't think there's a moment of asking themselves, what do they really want to be? what world do they really want? And combined with, which isn't the same as treat yourself today, but a really deep reflection in comparison of what is the world that is presented to me as the life I can have. And I think if that process, and I think for me, poetry gives me permission to do that, because it's like this weird, strange, totally socially unacceptable thing to do. It doesn't make any sense. And so I'm at every turn. It
doesn't make any money either, right?
It doesn't. And so at every turn, I'm conscious of the fact that there are alternatives to making money. There are alternatives to participating in a value system that I would reject if I gave myself time to think about it. And that, if that reflection were happening en masse, just what do I want? What do I want? What do I really want out of life? Then the sort of I want new wallpaper that feels like a sublimation of the real questioning that if it happened, would the Kathy Colwitz poem, what would happen if one woman told the truth about her life, the world would crack open. Yeah. You know, if one person looked at the truth of their life, if every person looked at the truth of their life, versus, you know, even what you thought when you were 5 years old, when you were 10 years old, what you thought you were entitled to. And I love to have that conversation with my students. I mean, I love to say, like, you got cheated out of the world they said you were going to be allowed to have. Yeah. And they don't necessarily know it, because a lot of them are really privileged. But when we read poems about class, about racism, about all sexual oppression, about all these things, they start to realize, oh yeah, the world is not this little shard of the world that I've been living in, the bubble. Every single one says their town nickname was the bubble.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, do they all come from the same town? That's so weird. But no, there's just, they all have the same nickname of the bubble. It's hilarious.
The bubble, yeah.
But once they see outside that, they feel ripped off. And I think that's a good place to be. If you can combine that with some hope.
Yeah, if you can combine some hope and a plan of action and yeah, which is goes back to organizing and the value of organizing people.
Yeah. You know, organizing is talking.
Yeah.
It's really talking. And poetry is talking. It's a lot of talking to other people that you know, can change the world.
Yes. I guess it's our podcasts, I guess.
I mean, I think podcasts are going to change the world. I think we've changed the world tonight.
Perhaps.
We talked a lot.
Yes, we did.
To each other. I feel changed. Yes. I do feel changed. It's great.
Well, and on that happy note, it's time for the bottom five.
Oh, my.
Ooh, how's that for a transition?
Woo!
It's time for a bottom five. The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
Ready as I'll ever be.
All right, question one. If reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be?
Okay, well, reincarnation is real. Reincarnation as a disease is questionable, but
well, I mean,
I'll
what
roll
if
with
it's,
it.
If it's the hierarchy of being, and you, like, totally screwed up.
Oh, no.
Actually, what if you were supposed to, like, just run a small business, because those people are the people who determine. A small business in a country town. Small town USA. Those are the people who, you know, Palinism rule the world or should rule the world. That's and so this whole urban poet activist thing. So you got to start over
up.
At single cell.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So you have to start over single cell. What would you? But you got to choose. You got to choose. Like you got to be a disease. What would you choose?
An infectious disease. Oh yeah. My gosh. Oh. Okay, fine. I would just be HPV.
Oh!
This is pretty harmless and everyone already has it. Human papillomavirus.
There you go.
70% of young women have it. Really isn't a big deal. I have it. I'll go out there on the record and say that. I'm the new majority. And
there you go. Silent majority, no less.
You can
take back the idea of silent majority.
I can't
believe
you forced me to admit that I have HPV, but that's because there's no shame around it, because almost everyone has it.
Yeah.
So yeah, something totally innocuous.
There we go. All right, that's good.
That's a cop-out answer.
No, that's fine. That's a great answer. Actually, that's a unique and original answer.
All right. Because Ebola was going to be my second choice, but then I knew that that was not my second choice immediately as soon as I thought
and
it.
And Ebola, you know, the thing about Ebola is, you know, it just doesn't live up to the hype. Oh, that's not true. Oh, that's mean. Awful. Okay, question two. What is the strangest injury you've ever suffered?
Okay. Well, I'm going to answer this cryptically just by saying sometimes you cook with jalapeno peppers and then sometimes you go to the bathroom.
Yes!
And if you haven't learned your lessons, you will sustain a very unpleasant injury.
Yes. Ooh, I will say, though I will say, not that this is a one-up game, but my pepper cooking related injury was I once, and this is just my own brilliance as a human being, I was making chili rellenos. And you know, and you cut the chili open, and you shove the chihuahua cheese in there. But of course, you got to clean the seeds out first. And so I, you know, stuck my finger in there and got the seeds out and washed them, and you know, was doing that. And so I was deep frying these peppers with the cheese in it and everything, and my eye was a little itchy.
Ugh.
And I rubbed my eye, and poblano peppers aren't that hot or anything.
Yeah.
Within seconds, I was in the fetal position on the floor of my kitchen.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, blood forever! And then I'm just laying there, I was like, oh my god, this sucks. And I get to the sink, and I'm trying to wash my eye out, and I realize that I had, you know, hot oil on high. An open flame, you know? And I just thought to myself, I had this horrible moment, I was like, oh, this would be the stupidest way ever to burn my house down.
And you should make that one of your bottom five questions. What if you had to burn your house down?
That's
what would be the way that you would choose to do it.
That would well. What would your way be?
I'd be your neighbor that night.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was, you know, my old Greenfield house. Yeah, we had about 2.5 feet between the houses, and the roofs actually overlapped. Uh-huh. So that would about fire bad. Fire's bad. Yes. All right, question three. You're not getting off the hook with coming up with your own question. Question three. It's not a question, actually. This is a prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood. So you can't be like, that time we went to Disney World or whatever. No.
Uh-huh.
Happy but unremarkable. It was just a day or a moment that you remember fondly now that maybe wasn't necessarily special or whatever, but was cool.
Well, it's going to involve the Snorks.
Okay.
It's all, enough said. I mean, television was my childhood.
And
you
too.
Know, people say that's a bad thing. I think I turned out awesome. I really feel like I benefited from television. And we just had a rinky-dink TV on a really, really rinky-dink TV stand. And it's Saturday morning, and I'm not going to want to watch whatever dumbass show is after the Snorks. Maybe it was the Smurfs. No offense, maybe it was the Smurfs. I didn't care for the Smurfs, but the Snorks were so delightful to me.
Mm. Though the Smurfs were a socialist utopia.
Maybe I wasn't ready for that. I think I was too already, you know.
Though the gender imbalance of the... Maybe that was the thing. Maybe the gender imbalance of the Smurfs.
They were blue.
There was one Smurfette, though.
Yeah.
That was it. There was, it's like, intense. All of womanhood is embodied in one Smurf.
It's really
There's intense. All these other, like, infinite varieties of male Smurfdom.
Creepy the way bees are creepy.
Yeah. Oh, that's maybe what they were modeling it after.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe I put an asterisk on my gendered critique of the Smurfs. All right, the Snorks. All right. Question four. Actually, no, we're going to go in a reverse order. This is going to be my question five. Question four, then. What would your idea of purgatory be like?
Hmm.
Let's get back to the whole, you know, death and afterlife theme here.
Yeah.
What would your idea of purgatory be like?
Well, it would probably involve doing crunches and other repetitive anaerobic exercise.
Mm.
What else? Purgatory. Purgatory is the place where you're just sort of endlessly waiting.
Yeah. Well, unless you're Dante, where there's some suffering, but you're kind of ipso facto already in heaven.
Yeah.
But you're just suffering to get better.
I think it would be like a kind of rotating stations of filling out tax returns, doing crunches, Kegels. And for those of you who don't know what Kegels are, they are they're so boring. You basically are trying to strengthen your pelvic floor. Basically, imagine you're going to the bathroom and you try to stop peeing. Like, hold your pee.
Ah!
That would be it, too. Just having to endlessly... This is it. Having to endlessly hold your pee while doing Kegels and crunches and filling out tax returns. And the only thing you can eat are those, Wasa crackers.
Ooh, that's hard. That's hard.
And it all happens in the Allegheny County holding cell, where I spent 19 hours without... No lawyer phone call. That's a myth. They don't give you a phone call.
Mm.
And they don't tell you how long you're going to be in there. And it's really cold. And there's fingernails all over the floor for some reason. And people just sleep on the floor because they're exhausted. So all of this would be going on in one of those rooms.
Ah, all right. I could.
That's pretty borderline hellish. But
yeah, well, you know, again, if you go Dante's Purgatory.
Yeah, yeah, it was kind that of inspired me.
Yes. All right. You're almost out of the woods.
All right.
Question five. This is the Christopher Hitchens Memorial question. Of the living villains of history. Living villains. So these are villains of history alive right now. Whose obituary would you like to write? If you could have the honor as a writer to write their obituary, tell it like it is or whatever, what living villain right now, whose obituary would you like to write?
Wow. It's a toss-up. My initial impulse was Chip Blankenship of Massey Energy, who decided it was cheaper to avoid 300 safety violations. I mean, to incur 300 safety violations and just pay the fine than to actually make his mines safe for the workers. And then workers were killed in the Big Branch explosion. That's one. Jeffrey Romoff is a close second. Just because I feel so close to Jeffrey. He's so nearby. He's the CEO of University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC. And he is the model of predatory capitalism.
In nonprofit organizations clothing, yes.
So I'd say... They might turn out to be the same person.
Yeah.
Which I might find out in the autopsy.
Yes, this is true. This is true. Yeah, you get the autopsy.
That would be report. The focus of my obituary was that they were actually the same person.
Ah, nice. Well, I think that's about it. Now you do have a book for sale at some point, right?
I do.
This is now time for you to shamelessly hawk. Speaking of capitalism.
Yeah.
Yes.
Lines the Quarry is my book. It's through Omnidon Press. It was the winner of the first or second poetry book prize from Omnidon. And if you go on their website, you can buy it.
Yeah.
You can buy it on Amazon, but you'll feel shitty about yourself if you do. You can also buy it from where I think you should buy it, which is Small Press Distribution, SPD Books. That is the place to get all your small press needs met.
Yes. And I will have links on the website to that. Speaking of the website, let's see. So our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find, links to people's books and stuff, where you can also find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. One word. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And, of course, We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook, because everything must be on Facebook or it doesn't exist. Thanks to Brett Zorick, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.